Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, August 10th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or listening through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever discovered, encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of that infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet itself, a simple PDF file, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have called in and been stepped through the worksheet process. You can also download the app from your app store. Type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and you'll have access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often because that frequently stimulates conversation, questions, testimonials. And if you're one of those, our caller number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number and you'll be announced by your area code and we can have a conversation. Alternatively, you can shoot us an email, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeanie at whyagain.org, whyagain.org. So, we are doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 222nd day of the year, and today's workbook lesson reads, The Creator is with me. I live and move in the Creator. The Creator is with me. It is my source of life, the life within, the air I breathe, the food with which I am sustained, the water which renews and cleanses me. It is my home wherein I live and move, the spirit which directs my actions. It offers its thoughts and guarantees me my safety from all pain. It covers me with kindness and with care. It holds in love the offspring of creation, who also shines on creation. How still is he who knows the truth of what he speaks today? Father, we have no words except your name upon our lips and in our minds, and we come quietly into your presence now and ask to rest with you in peace a while. So the Pam Grout has this RSO abbreviation, which she refers to as rip that sucker out, because one of the primary people who brought us the Course in Miracles said, anything that doesn't fit for you in your life or turns you off, just leave it and move on, because there's plenty in the Course in Miracles that will resonate for you and that will be helpful. And so, you know, a large percentage of these next lessons for Pam Grout are some of those RSOs. And so today's lesson 222 is titled, I Feel It in My Fingers, I Feel It in My Toes. And she quotes Abraham Hicks as saying, it is natural for you to play, to skip, to dance, and anything else is resistance. Pam Grout writes, the judging mind has a limited yet consistent repertoire. It goes something like this. This is wrong. This bozo sucks. I better do something and fast. Lesson 222, I live and move in love, is the way that Pam Grout summarizes this lesson. I live and move in love. This reminds me that all of those previous statements, this is wrong, that bozo sucks, I better do something fast, all of that is wrong. Love is my reality. It's the actuality. It's in the air I breathe, the food I eat, the water that renews and cleanses me. And when I finally slow down and rest long enough to notice, I am floored. The divine is so conspicuous. And I can't help but wonder, how could I have missed all of this? How could I have missed this presence that permeates all things? So that's our lesson for today. The truth is, I live and move and breathe the energy of creation, the energy of love. And everything else is false. So we have 50 minutes to talk, or even longer if we want, because Michael and Jeannie are taking the day off and we're having a recorded second half of the show today. But we're here, and we have time for comments and questions and testimonials, refutations, soliloquies, answers. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, I'll open up your microphone and we'll have a conversation. I had the privilege this morning, rather early this morning, of interviewing a gentleman in Scotland who is part of a company, Jacobs.com. You can look it up for yourself. It's a global company that does construction work. And this global company that does construction work, over $14 billion in revenue yearly, over 55,000 employees. And Paul, that I spoke with this morning for the interview, has somehow managed to convince the leaders of this corporation that mental health should be a priority in their company. Not only that, he has spearheaded the 1millionlives.world.world. So not .com, not .org, but .world. And you can go to that website, oml.world, and you can get access to a completely free and private mental health assessment. You can do the brief check-in, or you can do the full check-in. And after you answer all the questions on the full check-in, it will score it and give you the areas, a breakdown of the areas in your life where you're doing really well and where you're not doing so well. And if you choose to use this as a tool, it's like a shorthand version of what Michael Rice has developed that he calls the personal code evaluation. This is a shorter version of that. And it's designed to help people stay on top of their mental health and wellness. And once you take that check-in and then you look at the results, there's links there for all kinds of support. Should you feel like, well, you know, in the area of relationships or in the area of social media problems, in the area of physical well-being or exercise, I need some help. There are links to resources. And this is completely free. They developed this in this company originally with the thought that they could use it to help their employees have better lives and then be more productive and then have a better workplace, et cetera. And after a while, they thought, well, now that this thing is developed and seems to be working well, why don't we offer it to the friends and family of our workers? And then it wasn't too long before somebody said, well, wait a minute. If this is really good and beneficial, why don't we offer it to our clients and their workers and their friends and family? And eventually they said, well, wait a minute. Why don't we just make it open to everybody? Open source this thing and start pushing a global initiative for mental health and wellness and give people a tool that they can use frequently to do a check-in and find out how they're really doing. Because most of us have a tendency in our culture to just keep plodding along and keeping our nose to the grindstone, showing up for work whether we're feeling healthy or not, being rewarded for perfect attendance even when it's not really healthy for us as individuals or the workplace as a whole. And so they put together this assessment and they put it out on the internet for free, and I would encourage you to check it out. OML, 1 million lives, OML.WORLD. And if you go there and you check it out and you like it, give me some feedback. I will make sure to give that feedback to the people at Jacob's Company and Paul Hendry, who I interviewed this morning. And this is just one more example of how really bright, really well-intentioned people are working in the world to make this a better place. And I think it was Mr. Rogers' mother who would say to him, whenever there was tragedy in the world, she would say, look for the helpers. Don't get depressed. There's always going to be more people helping than there are people who are doing bad things or people who are overwhelmed. So this is yet another example. Here is a company with phenomenal resources that is not just looking at how can we add to our bottom line, but looking at how can we make our company a better place and the world we live in a better place. And you, as a listener to this show, get access to that. Now you can find out about it and you can spread it around so anybody that knows you can get access to this very useful, very well designed, in my opinion, as a psychologist with 47 years of experience, very well designed, very useful check-in assessment. And then a quick report that tells you which are the areas in your life by your own report that you would benefit the most from making some positive change in. And then if there's something that you would benefit from making a positive change in it, but you don't have the resources, they have links to resources. It's very similar to what the SameHereGlobal.org website does, in that they have a list of integrative practitioners, and they have a list of people who will support, and they have a whole, you know, website full of people who say, hey, look, I've struggled with mental health issues just like you. And so normalizing the conversation helping people assess their situation and giving them access to tools to resolve their situation, three strikes and you're in. That's what we're about. And that's what Michael and Jeannie Rice are making available here on the whyagain.org website, a whole host of tools that will help you learn about what are the areas in your life that you're hiding from yourself or your life experience that you've somehow reached the conclusion it's too much or too intense or too scary or too sad for you to face directly. And therefore, you've created this part of your life that many would call the unconscious. And once you've discovered some of those pieces of your consciousness that you've been hiding from yourself, they provide powerful and effective tools to start resolving some of those difficulties. It begins with the reality management worksheet, but it moves on to the three early memories of conflict, the mind shifter targeted journaling tool, the codependent to interdependent worksheet, where I get to use my phenomenal ability to give advice as a tool to make my own life better. And, you know, the hit parade goes on. There are all kinds of other worksheets there, the commitment tool, the responsibility communication tool. Wonderful tools available absolutely free. And even though they're not packaged in the same kind of very expensive, glitzy website that the oml.world and the sameheareglobal.org website have, because they've got more resources, the tools available at whyagain.org are off the charts good and effective. And if you haven't tapped into them, we encourage you to do that. And once you've done that and you've had some experience with it, either through the app or through the printed worksheet, give us a call. We're here 5 days a week in our current format, 2 hours a day. We also have support groups happening. And there are support groups that happen that are not part of the Tuesday and Thursday night group that I host out of Illinois, but now we support them being attended globally through the Zoom platform. But there are other people who are doing support groups, and you can find out where they're located and a list of them, or you can email Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and she'll send you a list when she's got time, or point you to that point in the or spot on the website. And maybe you live near somebody or close enough to somebody who's holding a support group that you could actually attend in person. Or maybe a group that, other than the two that we host, maybe you could find out that they're hosted through Zoom and you could attend one of theirs if it's a more favorable day or time for you. We are going to whatever links we can within the range of resources we possess to make these tools available to every mind, heart, and being on the planet, whether they have any money to pay for them or not. And the reason we do that is because our experience has been it makes our lives better, and what we learn from these spiritual teachings is we are all connected. There is no separation. So if I make my life better, your life gets better. If you make your life better, my life gets better. And that's why we do the work we do. I had somebody call today and say, well, I'm supposed to be at a session with you, but, you know, I don't know what to do because I was with somebody over the weekend and now they've been tested positive for COVID and they're not feeling well. And so here's a person who is really focused on doing what's right, Well, that's essentially what this show is for people who are focused on doing what's right, making the world a better place, being aware as much as we can of the impact of our choices, of our actions and reactions on ourselves and others. And even though, you know, this person might have had plans that were going to be fun for the weekend, or, you know, now they're going to do the right thing, which, you know, however it pans out for them, is probably going to be, you know, getting tested and getting isolation, and not exactly fun, not the fun they had planned, but because it fits in their mind what is the right thing to do, they're willing to do it. They're willing to put in the extra effort and do it. So, if you're listening, whether you're live or in the archives, our assumption is you're one of those people who's interested in making your life better, who's interested in having a positive impact on your world and the people around you. And if there is any way we can support you in doing that, we'd like to do it. We would like to be of service. That is our intention with this work, is to be of service. I was looking today about the possibility of lining up a best of recording for later in the week. I have several interviews that I'm trying to get done this week for the Journey Stream On Your Mind podcast. And I ran across the one from December 30th, I believe, 2015. And that particular hour just happened to be, it just happened to tumble out of my mouth in a way that was the best, most concentrated, even though it's an hour long, summary of the work we do that had ever expressed through me. And it's available for listen. I mean, all of these best of shows that we put out are available through the archives, and some of them have been singled out and they're available on the audio library page of the mindshiftersacademy.org website. So, you know, please know that one of the more powerful and effective resources that's available free through the yagain.org and the mindshiftersacademy.org websites is the archive of lectures, talks, interviews, radio shows that we've done that have been highlighted by people as being especially powerful, potent, or relevant. And yet, Michael and Jeannie are paying their own money to maintain that. I'm paying my own money to maintain that. And it's available as a resource for people. Absolutely free. Again, why would we do that? Well, because it makes everybody's lives better. And when you understand that you live in a community, and that whether you're conscious of it or not, you are part of a community, and what you do and say has an impact on others, then it makes sense to, where you can, when you're moved to, spend some of your energy and resources in a way that benefits others, even if you're not consciously aware of it at the time that benefit takes place. So I don't know, is anybody ever going to listen to the archives that I put on the mindshiftersacademy.org website? I don't know. Maybe some people will. Maybe only a handful. Maybe eventually hundreds will. I don't know. But it's out there. And that's why, you know, I had to take the same approach when I pick up a worksheet. Is this worksheet going to really knock out this issue and leave me with joy and a feeling of bliss and contentment and accomplishment? I don't know. It might be one of the many worksheets I do that leaves me feeling bland or blank or perhaps even a little bit more agitated than when I started. I don't know. But my willingness to use the tool is more important than the individual specific results I get from any individual application of that tool. My willingness to use the tool is more important than any individual results I get from any single application of the tool. And I encourage you to try that for yourself until you experience it, and or call and ask for specific examples or contact other people you know who've used these tools consistently over years and look at their results. Get, you know, live vicariously through them, perhaps to generate some motivation to do some more worksheets or to do some more EFT tapping sessions or to do some more breathing sessions. And by breathing sessions, I mean anything that works for you. You can, maybe you have training in Michael Rice's still point breathing. Maybe you've just learned the in one side of the nose, out the other from, you know, some pranayama yoga. Maybe you've tapped into the breath work that I encourage people to do, where you take a nice full set of air in your lungs, hold it for a couple counts, and then resist the exhale so your exhale is at least, you know, 4 to 8 times longer than the inhale. Breath work is a part of every good self-care and religious and spiritual training I've ever encountered. And there's a reason for it. The power of the breath to facilitate healing and the movement of energy through our system has been known for thousands and thousands of years. So your willingness to engage your breath, your willingness to become more mindful, your willingness to apply tools, and gratefully we have tremendous tools available absolutely free. Your willingness is going to be one of the greatest determiners of the success you have in creating or constructing a more loving, a more gratifying life. And I'm grateful to be able to offer support in these tools because, as I often say in the introduction, these are the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered in my over 47 years of doing therapy. It includes the doctoral training in clinical psychology and all the postdoctoral seminars and trainings and intensives that I've been to. This stuff works, and you don't need a doctorate, and you don't need to have off-the-charts charisma. You don't need to have healing hands. You don't need to be able to see auras in order for these tools to have powerful benefit in your life. So, what's on your mind? What's a comment? What's a question? What's an answer? What's a struggle you're wrestling with in your life right now? Ellen, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me? Okay. I don't really need support, so if someone else raises their hand, please defer to them. But if no one else is going to have a conversation with you, I would like to talk about the distinction between emotions and feelings. And if you, in your work, make a distinction. And the reason that I'm asking is because this book that I told you about that I'm reading now, he has a big, long chapter. I'm not even finished with the chapter, but there's so much in it about the title of the chapter is called Embracing Your Dark Feelings, but he goes into great depth between what he calls emotion and what he calls feelings. And is that something that you, in your work, make a distinction between?
Well, I do when people bring it up just for clarity. And I don't know what the distinction is that this author is making, but I'd be happy to, you know, have you enlighten us about that. The distinction that I make when people ask about that in this work is that a feeling is a sensation. So a feeling is hot, is cold, is tingly, is heavy, is light. It's a sensation at some level. It might be an actual physical sensation, feeling. It might be more of, you know, one of those ethereal, I just have this sense kind of a feeling. And emotion is the word that we reserve for a certain category of mental, emotional impressions that we get that contain the physical sensations, but they're tied to a certain pattern of thought.
Okay.
So I'm sad. Why? My thought is I've lost my favorite pocket watch and I'll never get it back. So I have sadness. And I can feel the physical sensations that go along with that thought that I'm sad in the body. So what do you have to offer from this author?
Yeah, it's very similar. He basically says that emotions are created by the egoic mind. So without the egoic thinking, you know, thinking of the lower mind, we don't experience emotion. And that's pretty much what you just said. It's tied to a thought.
Yes.
And of course, it wouldn't be a God thought. It would be an ego thought.
He says
that feelings come from some place much deeper than the ego. It's pre-ego. And he says that also that feelings are intelligent, where emotions are not, because they just put you back into that same pattern, that loop of reaction, and then more of that same feeling, and you know, more of the thoughts that go along with that feeling. It doesn't ever really lead you somewhere or out of that. It's just kind of like it's not intelligent, I guess. But yeah, and then he has a section where it's called the darkest feelings, which, you know, it just so happened that just journaling this morning about my, you know, experience in these dreams with these feelings, and then I happened to read this, right? And, I mean, I could read, I think it's very, really good information, so, you know, I could read a few paragraphs of this if you're up for that.
Okay. And help me understand what's the relevance here? The paragraphs you want to read are about what?
About embracing or understanding the really dark feelings, not the emotions, but the feelings, because that's what, according to him, really, it's kind of like the gateway you need to go through to get to where you really want to go, into the blissful feeling.
Okay, so it sounds like he's defining feelings in this sense as a kind of deeper inner knowing. Is that what you would, is that an accurate?
Yeah, I mean, he says there's definitely intelligence in them, but until you actually like start, you know, putting your awareness on them instead of running from them, do you ever get to that knowingness or that intelligence that's in them?
Right, but there is an intelligence in them, a deeper inner intelligence.
Yes.
Right? And you only get access to that if you're not running from it, but you're sitting with it and asking to be taught by it, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Right?
Because he says that what happens often when those feelings come up, the ego, which cannot handle something it doesn't know what it is, right? The ego will co-opt the feeling and turn it into an emotion because it'll put a label on it. so put a label on a feeling that really has no label, because he says true feelings are pre-verbal. So the ego will put a label on it, and then it turns into an emotion, and it's like what you are, and then it's, you know, then all the stories start up, you know, because it's trying to explain something that it can never comprehend.
That makes sense. And it's also, you know, since they're using the word ego here, it brings me back to one of the definitions of ego from a lot of great spiritual traditions, is that ego is this collection of thoughts that's born of fear. So the root of ego is fear. And mm-hmm. what's the fear based on? Well, most of these traditions would say it's based on the fear that gets generated when we pretend we're separate from our source.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, again, the part you were going to read is what?
It's talking about the darkest feelings, because these are the ones that really hold the opportunity for breakthrough, but yet they're the ones that we're the most afraid of. And tend to,
okay,
you know, that you...
Okay, so when you use a word like dark,
yeah,
to me,
well,
it has already a judgment level to it. Does it fit, from what you've read about this, to change that word to intense?
Well, the way he describes it, because he calls them dark, not only because there's like a disturbing kind of feeling to them, but also because they're not known. They're like in the dark. They're not known. How does he put it? He says, I refer to these feelings as dark, not only because they are disturbing, but more specifically because you cannot easily describe them. And he says, and when your ego is experiencing something it cannot name and thereby comprehend, it feels like it is being invaded and overcome. This is part of why these feelings are so disturbing. And this is like exactly describing what I was experiencing in those dreams I was telling you about yesterday. So I was like, oh, okay. So that's good news, you know.
So if we start with this, that what we're describing is simply energies that are neither good nor bad, they're just there. And when we use the word dark, we're being clear that we don't mean bad. It's not a negative. It's a descriptive in terms of it's something we don't see directly.
Exactly.
Right? So it's dark in terms of we have not had the ability to, or we have not yet turned the light of awareness on these energies.
Right.
And that's all they are. That's
right.
The only thing that directs us to use the word dark. And
yes,
so, you know, I would substitute for anybody who has the deep loading of meaning around the word dark as being negative and bad or pejorative, you know, insulting, less than, that you try substituting the word intense. These deep, intense feelings. And we're calling them feelings because they are just things we experience before we've labeled them with an egoic word that creates the emotional response.
Right.
All right. That track for you?
Yeah. I said the only thing that I would add is that for me, I mean, and I would guess for most people, I mean, the initial sense, because the ego is going to, like, automatically jump in, is that it does feel evil or dark or and that is actually a sign It's not that it is dark, but that you're getting close to the light. Like, in other words, it's a great opportunity, something you want to move towards, not away from, because my reaction in the dream was always to get away from this. This was not safe. This was a horrible thing, and now I'm really understanding that, wow, it's not at all what I thought it was, and I'm learning here, you know, what the opportunity is. And I just thought it would be helpful to share that, because I'm sure I'm not the only one that goes into fear when, you know, experiencing something like this.
Okay. So did you want to start reading?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I'll skip the first couple of paragraphs because I think we kind of already discussed that. He says, it's impossible to accurately name the dark feelings, so inevitably you have to resort to the use of metaphors, like referring to the feeling as demonic or hellish, or you have to use similes such as, it is like my life is draining away, it is as if no one really sees me, or it is as though I am losing my mind. This use of simile is one of the ways you can know that you are dealing with the dark feeling as opposed to an emotion. But this kind of description is itself another story, never the actual feeling itself. These feelings can only be embraced by awareness, never by the thinking mind. I call the darkest feelings abysmal because as you turn your awareness toward them, you never seem to be able to get to the bottom of them. They appear to have no beginning and no end, as if they are outside time. When you are besieged by the abysmal, it is as if you have always been this way and always will be. These feelings seem bigger than you, as if you are being swallowed up in them like Jonah in the belly of the whale. Your thoughts may try to tell you that the feeling will pass, which of course it will, but the experience itself is that the feeling seems, while you are in it, unrelenting and unending. Experiencing the abysmal feelings is more like an initiation or a rite of passage than a mere emotional experience. It has the potential to open big doors deep into the soul. I also sometimes refer to these feelings as untamed, as contrast them with emotions, which are referred to as tamed. Emotions like hate can be very destructive, so categorizing hate as a tamed emotion is intentionally provocative. I want you to realize that emotions, even those like hate, are tamed because no matter how unpleasant or destructive they may feel and be to you and others, they never actually threaten your ego. On the contrary, they are your ego. Emotions such as self-loathing or hatred may humiliate your idealized self, which wants to come across as happy, fair-minded, or reasonable. But humiliation is still the emotional state of an intact ego. It still upholds a sense of identity. You may feel ashamed of your own emotionality, of how jealous or resentful you are being, but such shame is again just another emotional state of your ego. In this sense, emotions are like domesticated animals in a farmer's barnyard. Not always cooperative, couth, or flattering, but always ultimately under the farmer's, the ego's, control. They are never truly wild like a zebra, an animal so undomesticated that it can easily die of shock just by being transported from one area to another. As crazy as emotions can make you, it is a familiar, repetitive craziness that never brings you to something new. In comparison, untamed feelings are truly wild rides that confront you with the unknown depths of your being, where it can seem as though who you are as an ego is being annihilated. But when you bring awareness to these feelings, you aren't annihilated. You are made more transparent to life and profoundly present. And then he gets into a whole big section about fear specifically, which he says is a true feeling, but it's so often co-opted by the ego. And that, you know, the key there is to always move your awareness to the sensation in the body that you are experiencing.
Okay. All right. So let me just interrupt you before I lose my train of thought, because you've presented so much stuff.
I know.
and the tie-in for me is that my interpretation, what's striking my brain when you read that, is that these feelings that he's talking about, which are not emotions, these are these deep energies which hold tremendous information for us, and we can't get access to the information or the lesson unless we learn to sit with it.
Exactly.
And most of the time, as you were saying when you had your dream, your impulse, almost unbearable, overriding impulse, is to run away, to get it to end somehow, et cetera. And when I run away from these deep energies, he would call them dark, but these deep, intense energies that I don't have direct access to, conscious awareness of, in order to get the benefits of them, I have to learn to sit with them. And we are not trained to do that in this culture. So here's the tie-in to the Michael Rice work. If I can learn that when I have a negative emotion, any of them, anger, fear, sadness, grief, confusion, hurt, bitterness, resentment, thoughts of vengeance, whatever, if I can discover the process within my mind and even the egoic mind to begin with that is creating that, and gain some mastery over that process by using the reality management worksheet, I open my experience of being able to survive these energies and sitting with them, breathing into them, asking to be shown, canceling my need to be right. I build mastery at exactly what this author says needs to happen, which is I need to be able to sit with it.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be able to sit with these more intense, deeper, he would call them dark energies, if I'm going to be able to learn from them, to attain, achieve, the words are failing me, the lesson, right? And I'm not taught that in my culture. And I don't think it's a coincidence that repetitive use of the reality management worksheet and or the targeted journaling that Michael calls the mind shifter will do just what this author is saying I need to do, will help me build the skill to do exactly what this author is saying I need to do, which is to sit with these energies rather than run from them.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to gain the confidence in my ability to identify where and when I'm creating an emotion and sit with it and dismantle it and then ask to be shown the process in my mind that's doing that, and then asking to be shown what else is there for me to learn, which is the thing in my interpretation of what your author is writing about, which is the thing that opens the pathway for me to get access to these deeper, more intense energies.
Yeah, it's like getting underneath the emotion to what the true feeling is. That's kind of covered over by the emotion, and of course the emotion
process gain this lived experience of being able to survive the emotions and its intensity, which provides me with a greater sense of confidence that I can weather the storm of these other deeper energies.
Yeah, he says right here, to fully live, we have to sit down in front of fear and let it teach us about ourselves. When we do, it becomes one of our greatest allies in the journey to wisdom and healing. But he says the way that he is talking about doing that is, because he says what happens is, like, when you feel fear, The ego is automatically going to tell you what you're afraid of, like, and it'll tell stories about, oh, what might happen next or whatever, and it's going to intensify the fear. Any story that the ego tells you is just going to intensify the fear. So the most important thing is to, you know, just put all your awareness on the sensation in the body. And he said this, he said, how does he say here? He says, if you turn your awareness toward fear instead of thinking about it and actually allow yourself to experience the sensation of fear while refusing to let that sensation carry you into stories, the stories will dissolve as fast as they form. And so that's kind of his way of saying how you kind of face the fear and sit with it. And then he says it begins to transmute.
I would have to agree.
Yeah.
That's part of why it is so powerful for me once I recognize the early warning signs of a negative emotion, how it's powerful for me to take a breath and turn the focus inside and ask myself, how am I creating this emotion? What's the story I'm telling myself that's creating this emotion?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's got me actually facing the situation at the cause level rather than wrestling with some external effects, which are always internally produced anyway. So I don't buy the ego's story that I am feeling this way because of someone or something outside of me. I'm asking to be shown the truth of how is it that I'm creating this?
Yeah. And then this is interesting. So
wait a minute before you go on, because I don't want to run out of time without this. Can you tell us again, please, the author and the title of the book?
Richard Moss, Inside Out Healing.
Because we haven't mentioned that yet in this segment.
Right.
So this is, again, referencing, we talked about Richard yesterday or last week. I forget when you first brought it up. But Richard Moss, Inside Out Healing is the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's got two books. Is this the author who did one in 2010 and 2011?
Oh, I think he has six books out. But it's interesting because if you really like him, he may be someone that you can even interview, because when I look out on Amazon, you know, he doesn't have a lot of reviews out there. So I don't think he's well known. I've never heard of anyone else mention his name. So he may be someone that would be interested in, you know, getting his name out there more. I mean, I don't, probably isn't, but you know what I mean? That he might be willing to do an interview with you anyway.
Yeah, my impression was that he was kind of past that point in his career, but I'll look into it and reach out to him. You know, he is, as you said, yeah, the Mandala of Being is the other book. So he wrote one of them in 2010 and the other in 2011, I believe, if I remember correctly. All right, so there we have it. I will make a note to reach out to him, and again, I thank you for the suggestion.
Sure. So, yeah, I was just going to mention, he says here, I thought this was interesting too, and maybe this is something you already know, but probably a lot of people don't. He says, in an evolutionary sense, feeling is a much older mode of consciousness than thinking. The large brain and highly convoluted cortex that supports the thinking of modern human beings is a newer development than the midbrain and thalamus that govern most of your feelings. It is feeling that dominates a young child's experience, because until the ego has developed, thinking is very limited. So again, it just goes to show you that it's something that is pre-ego. It's more soul. I think of it as feelings as like coming from the soul, as opposed to, you know, the ego, which are more what he's terming emotions. So I was just curious because I had never, you know, heard anyone make this distinction before between the two. And it's helpful for me because I know so often people ask me, well, how are you feeling? And I'd be like, I could never put any words to it. And now I understand why.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. As I said, I'll look into it, and I will probably give at least one of those books a read. I'm going to see if I can reach out to him and see what his thoughts are about either being on Mindshifters Radio or about the On Your Mind podcast.
Okay.
All right. So I will mute you and thank you again for your input. And I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'm about to kick off a discussion of the 12 steps and this work. This is an audio file that's just about an hour long from 2015 at Jeannie's request. I don't know if Jeannie and Michael will be back tomorrow, but I will, and we'll look forward to seeing you then. Blessings.
Welcome. Thank you, sweetie, and that's the plan, is to go back into the 12 steps. I'm not sure what happened to the clock yesterday. There was some kind of a time warp, because I swore that probably I was speaking about the responsibility communication process for about 20 minutes, and all of a sudden the show is ringing in my ear. Oh, time's up. So we'll go back to that tomorrow, and we may end up alternating a few more days. Who knows with the 12-step work, which I think is going awesomely, getting reports from several people that are really benefiting, Gail, from the input that you've got, and Dave and Dr. Tim. Just lots of really powerful input and an overview and understanding of the parallels and the way to put the two sets of tools together to enlarge the toolkit. So, fabulous. Delighted to be here. Gail, how do you be, young lady?
I am well. Thank you.
Wonderful. Anything new and exciting in your life?
Nothing new and exciting to be, well, okay, now that you mention it. last week when I was doing the 12 steps, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I had such a high level of vitality. And, of course, naturally, by Thursday and Friday, I hit a healing crisis. that is one new
good for
thing.
You.
Yeah, good for me. Next layer, right?
Well, that's what it's all about. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a new film out there that Jean and I went to see. That's how we're taking our intermissions from the intensity of what we're doing here between getting set up in the house and getting editing done. But we went to see, and I invite everyone who doesn't know what a healing crisis looks like or a healing process looks like to go and see the film, The Letters. And it's a story of the life of Mother Teresa, who has this experience of this super high vitality and direct communication from love, from the Creator. People would call it God, whatever word you want to use. I don't think love cares what you call it. It's kind of like one of my favorite sayings is, call me anything but late for dinner. Acknowledge the presence of love in your life, and you're acknowledging the Creator. So here, Mother Teresa has this call, and, you know, she's a school teacher. She's a cloistered nun. And all of a sudden, she gets this direct communication, which means super high vitality, as you're talking about. And a significant part of the rest of the film, aside from, you know, giving you a pretty good window on her work and some of the stuff she went through, some of the challenges she had, they introduce her spiritual advisor, who has, and I've ordered them because they've now been published, a copy of all her letters to him. And what I realized, if you go back and you read the lives of many of the saints or the mystics, what you find is people who have this beatific experience, this full-blown white light experience to the extreme and stay in it. And then the rest of their lives is torture. And they talk quite a bit in this film about Mother Teresa, who is doing this awesome, wonderful work based in love. And it's really powerful space of love that she holds for things that would turn most people's stomachs. And yet in her letters to her spiritual advisor, she's describing this torture that she's going through. And of course, I've read about that sort of thing before with the mystics. And what clicked is, I got it. What happens is when you get to that really, truly full-blown light experience, which is just beyond comprehension. You know, if you took the most delightful, awesome, fun, exciting, sweet, wonderful experience you've ever had as a human, and then you multiplied it by the largest number you can imagine. You know, when you were kids, you played the game of 100 quadrillion, million, billion, zillion, quadrillion, billion. You know, if you multiplied it by that, you wouldn't touch what that experience is. So here, Mother Teresa has that experience, transforms her life, and then she goes into process. And because she doesn't have the tool of forgiveness, her healing crisis just goes on and on and on and on. Without the awareness of what the symptoms of healing look like, people stay in it forever. The mystics, these tortured lives, and what they're being tortured by is the content of their own carbon-based memory, their own generational patterns. That there's the vitality to start to move it, but because they don't know how to crack it open, they get stuck in it. And a lot of people have, rejected the mystical experience because I don't want to go into that kind of torture. And what's happening is they're stepping in with the opening and the opportunity to clean up 1,000 generations of insanity that's gone before them. The hate, the fear, the rage, the guilt, the quote-unquote demons that have plagued their generations. And it just was like a big opening for me to watch this and realize, that's what the mystics are describing as being tortured. They're in a major healing crisis, and because they don't know what drives their perception that is tortured, they don't know how to collapse it and go in and clean it up. An interesting view, and I was going to share that on the show at some point today, but you certainly created the opening when you talked about, along about day four, you go into a major healing process. And isn't it awesome that when we do step into that, and I can remember times when in the early days, and I didn't really understand what was going on, and a healing process would open and would go on for days. And now the same healing process, or perhaps a more intense one, will open, and I can be done with it in 10 minutes. Because I know how to do it now. I have the tools. These people didn't have first century Aramaic forgiveness. And so these things just went on forever. So it is nice to have the tools, isn't it, Gail?
It is. It is, for sure.
Yes.
And thank you for that piece as well. I mean, knowing now that, even Mother Teresa dealt with this and suffered. Wow. So that helps.
Only,
that helps
we
a
only
lot.
Suffer. Yeah, there's no demon that can make us suffer. What the Greeks ended up calling demons or evil spirits is simply the mind energy of generational patterns. That's where the torture comes from. And knowing how to crack it and remove it, forgive it, is just, monumental.
Agreed. I'm grateful to be on the team, and I'm grateful to be able to offer another piece.
So am I. While we're on that topic, let's see if Dr. Tim has any thoughts about that. Tim?
Okay.
Which one?
Just the whole thought of what was happening with the mystics. I'm sure you've probably read some of those things where these people are living these tortured lives. Does that fit for you? Does that make sense for you?
Yes, absolutely. And as you were talking, it was even making more sense. For years, in my studies and readings, I've heard about people who had these peak emotional experiences or enlightenment moments or gifts, whatever you want to call it, and then they end up living in a broken body. you know, car accidents that leave them in chronic pain, debilitating chronic diseases, you know, and they just keep going. Mayor Baba and Krishnamurti and all these people, many, many that I've read about, I forget the name of the book, but I read one recently where I talked about it a year or so ago on the show, and this monk who was just, he worked in the kitchen and became enlightened. And there he was in the last years of his life, racked in pain and physical pain, and they would go to comfort him, and he would say, no, I'm leave me here. I'm offering up my suffering.
Yeah, let me just suffer.
I'm doing it for God or whatever. So,
yeah.
And with the understanding that I've been building over the last 20 years or so, breaking out of the mold of thinking. I mean, I was raised in a Catholic tradition that had you, every time you were going through some kind of pain, we were told, offer it up for the poor souls in purgatory. Literally. Stay there, suffer. You know, you're kneeling on the floor because there aren't any padded kneelers left, so you're kneeling on the floor and your knees are hurting, and it's, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes into it, and there's pain shooting up your legs, and you're told just, you know, suffer it and offer it up for the poor souls in purgatory. So as I was listening to you talk about it, the little light bulbs are going on saying, you know what, I'll bet that's more the case, that this is a situation where people were, a lot of spiritual traditions say you can't storm the gates because my physical body in this moment doesn't have the vitality that could actually contain or survive experiencing the level of energy that it's ultimately capable of experiencing. It isn't vibrating at a high enough frequency. And when I get exposed to those higher level frequencies, if I'm not eating right, in good physical shape, in good mental and emotional shape, and armed with the tools to get rid of the energies that don't belong, all I'm going to experience is an intense activation of a lot of negative energies that don't belong in my system, which we call symptoms. And so that light bulb was going off for me that perhaps a lot of these people who have suffered and suffered in silence and been the great saints and martyrs because they tolerate so much with a smile or they suffer through it, perhaps there's another way. And I think it's great that they don't get negative about their symptoms. And at the same time, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a way for them to actually process through the energy and be relieved of the symptoms?
Yeah, I think in that context of that story about offered up for the souls in purgatory, they'd probably be a whole lot happier and better off if we offered aliveness, joy, creativity than suffering, pain, and trauma. You know, it's just like the whole root of the idea of sympathy is suffer with somebody as opposed to being the space and holding the space of love. And I think that was Brother Lawrence that you were talking about that experienced his enlightenment while washing dishes. And yeah, if we can't process what needs to be processed, it's going to express in the battleground of the body. It's going to express symptomatically. So probably Gail has the answer as to exactly how long when somebody gets into the 12-step program, they have to do their work to be cured, to be finished with it. Was it a year, 2 years, Gail?
It took about 2 years to get through the steps the first time, but I continually work the rest of the steps every day. I work all the steps every day.
You mean in that first 2 years you weren't finished?
No, I was not finished after 2 years. I was not cured. I was not cured at all. Come on, you've seen my my personal coach evaluation scores when I first met you. No, I was not finished.
I'm a wise guy. And there are people who have knocked me when they say, well, you've been doing this for 45 years and you're not finished yet? No, not finished yet. Well, there must be something wrong with this. No, No, it's called a process. And when you realize, and I forget exactly the number, but, you know, in 30 generations of your bloodline, if you sit down with a pen and paper, in 30 generations of your bloodline, there's over 1.7 billion people. 30 generations, 1.7 billion. You know, one yourself, one generation back to two generations, four, eight, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1,024. Doesn't take long to get up to a billion, and that's how many there are in 30 generations. And that's what we're talking about, inviting people in to clean up, because that genetic structure that they used to say was junk, the part of the genes that was junk, and originally they were saying over 90% of our genes are junk, the DNA is junk. It's not junk. It's the most exquisite database that ever existed. It carries every thought, every feeling, every reality from every generation. And if your so-called body, your multi-generational database, your body is going to be a fit instrument with which you incarnate the active presence of love, then you're going to have to clean out of it which is unlike love. And you start thinking about, you know, the ignorance that in this modern, enlightened day and age we live in, you know, we still live in a world where in the last 75 years we've killed over 275 million people in war. Not much enlightenment there. You know, what do you suppose life was like on most of the planet 5 generations ago, 10 generations ago? When Genghis Khan stocked the earth, what do you suppose it was like? What do you suppose it was like when the Han dynasty was murdering off the competing dynasties? You know, it's pretty amazing. When you think about that's born and bred in all of us, and to really, truly incarnate a human life, and for anybody who's new to the show, we have a simple definition for a human life. Hold a newborn child. And you know exactly what a human life is. It is clearly this awesome active presence of love. And we are meant to inhabit this form our whole lives long as the active presence of love. And the only thing that will ever inhibit us from doing that is the generational content that never belonged in a human life in the first place. And to have the courage to face and clean up that database is quite a piece of work. And the form of that work that we're tying in with the first century Aramaic forgiveness work, we spent the whole week, if you weren't on the show last week, we spent all week on, from Monday to Friday, on the 12-step program, a program for cleaning up this multi-generational database and coming out the other side as intact human beings. And I understand Magda has her hand up. Magda, do you have a comment for us on the 12-step program? Is Magda there?
Oh, hi. Oh, hi.
Hey there, young lady. Oh. Welcome.
Hi there. I called in because you had talked to me the other day about calling in on Tuesday. This is Tuesday, right? The responsibility communication.
Oh, actually, it was Monday that we did the responsibility communication, and we're carrying
well,
on with the.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
Okay, then I misunderstood. I thought you said Tuesday.
Okay. But anyway, we are going to pick it up again tomorrow.
So
I ended up spending the whole hour yesterday.
You have Gail there right now, right?
Right. We're going to pick up the responsibility communication again tomorrow. We didn't get through it yesterday, but we had, you know, announced last week that we'd do the responsibility communication yesterday and that we'd pick up the 12-step today. So if there's space tomorrow, it'd be awesome to hear from you because we're going to be back on responsibility communication.
Great, I'll do that. I do have one little comment to add to what you've been saying about being a martyr and putting up with the pain and offering it up and all of that. I was also brought up as a Catholic, so I understand those concepts. And I really love, and I want to pass on what my friend Sunny, you met Sunny, what she says is let me do everything, learn all my lessons, whatever I need to do with joy and ease. And I'm going, yeah, that really is a great intention. So I just want to pass that on. And then I'll call back tomorrow, okay?
Okay. Appreciate you. Blessings.
Okay. Hi, Gail. Blessings, everybody. Bye-bye.
So, Gail, I'm going to turn it back over to you, young lady. Go for it. What do you have in mind?
Yes, good to hear from you, Magda. what do I have on my mind? I wanted to offer, as long as we're on this topic of talking about the pain of the spiritual awakening and not being able to have the tools to go through this pain-free, is Bill Wilson as well went through a lot of pain. He had a bright light spiritual experience, which enabled him to maintain sobriety or get sober, and he worked the rest of the tenets of the Oxford group that did not make him immune to working those tenets, and then he developed and then was a part of writing the book Alcoholics Anonymous and being a co-founder of this movement. He still suffered, and he talks quite a bit about his depression. And he finally, I think about 22 years of sobriety, he got to a place of, hey, I can work the steps on my depression as well. And so he started to do that and relieve himself of his depression. So there are modern day sages as well that have suffered. And that puts a really good light on to people that I've put on the pedestal, like Gary Hicks, who died of cancer, who I was in extreme judgment of this summer, and as well as the passing of Ron Roth, who is one of my other spiritual gurus that I have sought through. I thought, you know, both of their suffering, I judged harshly, but now I understand why.
Well, my take, yeah, two things. One would be, there is no pain or suffering in the spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. That's a misnomer. The spiritual awakening or the spiritual experience takes us to a level of vitality where we can't hide the suffering anymore. But it's not caused by or any inherent part of the suffering experience. Now, the non-being world has a rule that says no pain, no gain. My rule is no pain, no pain. And if there's pain there, then you're going to get to deal with it. And by being vitalized through the spiritual experience, you're going to have the vitality then to bring out of hiding that which you've been hiding from yourself. And my experience of working with any kind of addiction is that the addictive substances in the work that I've developed in the 12-step, or pardon me, in the codependence to interdependence workshop, we define addiction as the compulsive use of any person, place, substance, or activity to, one, not listen to or follow our higher guidance or the spiritual experience. That's one use for addictive substances. And the other one is to anesthetize pain. So the spiritual experience gives the vitality to start to access and dig out the garbage that never belonged. And, of course, as with the mystics we were talking about, if one doesn't know how and doesn't have the tools, if you don't have a shovel, it's going to be pretty tough to dig a deep well. And so if you've got a power drill on a crane, you're going to dig a well pretty quickly. And the tools that, by and large, have been available have been pretty much, well, you know, we don't really know what's going on here, but here, tell you what, why don't you just go ahead and suffer and give it to God? God is love, and God will really enjoy your suffering. It's like, come on, give me an intermission here. That's insane. But it was the best explanation they had. First century Aramaic forgiveness, what Yeshua came to offer people was a huge drilling rig to dig that well, to drop down into the dissociated parts of the mind, bring them forward in the presence of love, and process through them. You don't have to hang around in suffering for longer than you're unwilling to do your work. And the work is, and the suffering is caused by the content of carbon-based memory, not by God. People have made up a story that it's all God's fault. You know, God's going to punish you. And that's all just pure garbage made up by people who didn't know any better, who were ignorant and did not understand. And so as we undo ignorance and come to understand, oh, I have a tool. I can do something with this. And that's the whole idea of the process.
Understood, and thank you for clarifying and tweaking that for me.
Cool.
I will. How about I recap what we talked about last
Let's
week real quick,
yeah,
and
just,
we will continue
sure, go
on.
For it.
And
okay.
I think wanted to
just,
add that.
Just...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. We've got a little bit of overlap here, so go ahead. I'll be silent here.
I think doing the responsibility communication at this point is excellent, because the next thing I was going to talk about is the amends process, which looks similar, believe it or not, to the responsibility communication. But I'll recap first, and we will move forward. What we talked about last week are the steps. We got up to step 7 on Friday. With a little side note about what sarcasm really is, and thank you for that piece as well. But anyway, step 1, it basically is I can't think, or I can't drink and I can't think. It's a 2-part step. And step 2 is about doing something different. Step 3 is a decision to finish the rest of the steps. Step 4 is writing down on piece of paper what our thinking looks like, looking at how we put ourselves in a position to be hurt. We address our resentments, fear, sex, conduct, and harms to others in the 4th step. And step 5, we admit the exact nature of our wrongs to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. And we talk about our thinking errors. And step 6, we become willing to get rid of those thinking errors, which are called character defects in step 6. And we ask ourselves this very simple question: are we ready to let go of everything that we see that is objectionable? Those are the things that we looked at in step 4 and talked about in step 5. And in step 7, we give those things up to God. It says we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Character defects and shortcomings are similar. They're errors in thought. If our aim is to be loving and we are short on love, that is a shortcoming. If our aim is to be tolerant and we are intolerant, that is a shortcoming, because we're short on tolerance, or we're short on patience, or we're short on love. I wanted to also share our 7-step prayer that is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a suggested prayer. It's a very, and it's not prayer by the definition of to capture God. It is more of a request of God, and it goes like this. Our Creator, I offer my, no, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. Our Creator, take me both good and bad. Take away from me every single defect of character that blocked me off from you and my fellows. Oh. And the rest of it is, grant me strength to do your bidding. And just a very simple, simple prayer, very powerful prayer. On some days, I don't know what a character what character defects are blocking me off from God. And some days, a character defect can be a character asset. It just depends on how I use it. And so that prayer, I believe, is very perfect, because it's asking God to take me both good and bad, and to take away everything that blocks me off. So I wanted to offer that. And with that offering, did you have any comments at all before we move on?
Right on track, and it ties right in with the step of 5B, where I ask Rukka for support in opening the space to come back into conscious relationship with all dissociated content and clean it out. Just exactly on track.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for that. What I said on Friday is that there's 6 and 7. 6 is we become willing. 7 is we do. 8 and 9 are similarly matched up with that. With 8, we become willing, and 9, we do. And I love it when you talk about willingness being the cosmic grief. And also when you mentioned that in your book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again, I very much appreciated that discussion with about willingness as well. So I wanted to add that. In step 8, what we do is we make a list of all people we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. That list of people that we have harmed comes out of our 4-step. Most likely all the people that I listed that I had resentments against, all the objects of fear, and also people that were on my sex conduct list and harms done to other lists will end up on my 8-step list. It's an ongoing list. Sometimes I take people off the list after I make amends. Sometimes I add people to the list as I continue to act out of selfishness, self-centered fear, or non-being mind, as you say. And so becoming willing to make amends to them all for me is to constantly pray for that willingness. And I have willingness to make amends to every person on my list except for one. And that person would be my stepfather. And in preparation for thinking about what I'm going to say about this step, I started to do worksheets on him, and because I'm getting to deeper and deeper realization that my resentment against him is harming me because I'm living with the chemistry in my own body. So that is a process in the making. So any comments before I go to step 9?
Oh, just nice catch on that one. To recognize that the original of it, you know, it's in my own form, and that resentment is something I need to forgive, remove from myself. It's the key to the whole process. Does that mean that I have to approve of everything that anybody or everybody's ever done? No, not in the least. But it does mean that I am willing to remove literally my capacity for resentment, for anger, for hatred, for fear, so that I can stand in the space of love, maintain my human life no matter what anybody else is doing. And then, of course, carry on with the work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Step 9 is made direct amends to such people, except when, wherever possible, would harm them or others. And this would be the case, one of the perfect examples would be to make amends to somebody that you cheated on, because that would harm them, and it would also harm the person that you cheated on them with. And it talks extensively, for instance, I had a really good friend that cheated on his wife and his brother by sleeping with his brother's wife. He's not going to go to his brother and say, hey, I slept with your wife, you know, but I'm really sorry for doing that. And also that would have not only harmed his brother, it would have harmed his brother's wife as well. So that's one example. It talks extensively about making amends in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's about timing. And it also says wherever possible. And the wording there opposed to whenever possible, saying wherever possible invites God into the process. It's about prudent timing. It's about inviting God into the process, not making amends out of ego or self-centered fear. And that's what I've done my whole life. I'm sorry. I'd like to apologize for doing this, but my behavior hasn't changed. And I believe that's why 8 and 9 are where 8 and 9 are, that we need to change before we start to pursue the process of amends, because I've apologized because I've had other things on my agenda to get something else out of somebody instead of being genuinely apologetic or wanting to make amends. And I also wanted to capitalize on the word amend.
instead of apology or saying I'm sorry. The word amend means to change the relationship. As an amendment to the Constitution changes the Constitution, or making amend in a piece of clothing changes the clothing or strengthens the clothing, making an amend in a relationship changes the relationship, and hopefully 99% of the time makes that relationship stronger. So I believe that there is a process between steps 1 through 8 that makes step 9 possible, and definitely with the invite of God into that process and using one's intuition in order to those amends. So any comments before I go into the wording that I've learned in the amends process?
No, go for it, please.
Okay. What I was taught, and most recently, once again, this is a skill set, kind of like step 5 is a skill set, to listen to somebody else's 4th step and 5th step. Making amends is a process, and there were specific words that my current sponsor gave me. I did a sponsorship change 5 years ago and went back through the steps with her, and she very much capitalized on the words, and which was a huge gift for me, because I'm one of those people that needs to be given the words and to make those words my own. And the main words to focus on is when I make amends to people is the admittance of wrong. I was wrong. I regret is the other word. Instead of being I'm sorry or I apologize, expressing regret. Instead of having guilt, shame, and remorse, there's a difference between guilt, shame, and remorse and regret. I regret that I behaved this way, or I regret the harm that I imposed upon you. And the next important idea to convey is, how can I make this right? The willingness to get right is very important. Letting go of the self-justification and the reasons why I did it and what they did in the mix, and taking total and complete responsibility for what I did. So, and staying on my side of the street, so to speak. And that, at that point in time, how can I make this right, is an invitation for me to listen to everything that they have to say, to express their side of it, and also to be given the opportunity to make that right. And then from there, negotiate on the best course of action to be taken to make it right.
My input there is that oftentimes I think this is a place where people try to figure it out, and I consider that to be the number one pseudo-solution of the non-being mind, if I could just figure out. And I think that a really powerful place to go in this step that, you know, that this work can deliver to that step is to really, truly be in the space of the love exchange, where love is fully conscious, active, and present in one or both or whatever number of people are involved in it, and that active presence of love can make things right that in a million years a hurt mind could never figure out or never come up with. The energetic dynamic of the miracle happens in that space when love is conscious, active, and present, rather than it being, you know, a negotiation. It's just, to me, the effort to bring, this is the space to, it kind of ties in with step 4 of the worksheet of I choose to tap into my newborn state, that active presence of love, and function as that. And when I am, you know, preferably the person I perhaps have a conflict with can bring that forward, it just opens doors that can't be fathomed by the intellect.
Understood. Understood. A lot of people think it's just about an apology, and I wanted to offer what I have learned with this step. The other thing that I wanted to offer, too, is when going through the worksheet in Florida, and I was like, where's the amends process in this? And Joel turned around and said, the amends process is when we offer a goal to them in the seventh step. And absolutely right. And then when you did the responsibility communication process, and Sarah did it with, and I can't remember the name of the other girl that she did it with, and we went through that sheet, I saw the amends process throughout that sheet as well. And most definitely I have used that to add to the amends process when I've been in a position to be able to, or I should say the honor and ability to, opportunity to make amends to somebody else. That has definitely been something, it's been an added tool for sure.
I think that both step four in the seven-step worksheet, where I choose to tap in, where I bring forward that active presence of love, is a big part of the amends process. And to me, the word amends there means healing as well, that there's going to be a reorganization of my energy system, which will then source things in a higher way, and literally a reorganization of the energy system of the person that I'm interacting with. And when that reorganization occurs, oftentimes the thing that was the big deal, I mean, one of the most common comments that I get when people get to step 6C in the worksheet, and they're looking at how do I see the situation I started out working with in step one now, and they're like, you know, I can't believe that my mind actually believed that that was such a big deal, because it's silly now. But you watch somebody going into the front end of the forgiveness process or the front end of an amends process, and they're ready to tear somebody's eyes out over this issue. It's so emotionally charged for them. But they have no idea that they're ready to tear somebody's eyes out because of the emotion in themselves. And when they go through the forgiveness process and forgive, remove that emotion, all of a sudden they look back at that exact same thing. It's like, well, it was so silly to be upset about that. That's the healing process that to me is so powerful when I cancel my goal and I invite Rukka in to rearrange the energy system. That's where the real power and the healing occurs. So I see both of those, that step four in the worksheet of bringing love present, and then step seven where I create a loving goal that I'm willing to offer to them, are both to be part of the amends process. And in between is the healing process that opens a space for both people.
Agreed. Well okay. Said.
Cool.
Yep, yep.
All right. So, well, anything else on step nine?
I believe I'm complete on step nine, and I think that is,
cool.
It just goes along perfect with the responsibility communication that was brought forward yesterday, and I look forward to being able to hear what happens tomorrow on the show with the examples. I think that you're going to have people call in for that. So we could continue the rest of the steps real quick. And
yeah, let's go for it.
Step 10 is we continue to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. As you'd mentioned earlier, how long did it take you to go through the steps initially? Well, 2 years. Am I still making mistakes? Am I done? No, I'm not done. And I really appreciate this step and the fact that Bill Wilson had the intuition to include this step. Along with the six tenets to close the gaps for us alcoholics and for others as well, because continue to make mistakes. And I need to look at those mistakes. And one of the things that I learned from the Aramaic forgiveness process, and one of the things that enables me to do a spot check inventory is if I'm doing anything or reacting to anything that is less than love, then it's on me. And that enables me to get back into being the space of love and to make corrections as quickly as possible. And there are directions in the big book about how to do step 10, and it's basically 4 through 9 every single day. There are two schools of thought about that, and some people think that it's 4 through 9 every single day. Some people also think it's 1 through 9 every single day. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter, just do it. You know, it is what my thoughts are. And but I have a tendency to lean towards the 1 through 9 every single day thought process. And the reason why I say that is because of the writings in the 12 and 12, which is a book that was solely written by Bill Wilson 15 years after he got sober. And its intent was to introduce the 12th tradition. He added essays about the steps to offer his experience 15 years later to the big book. And he talks about extensively restrain of pen and tongue, you know, delay taking action before you get to that inventory process. And for me, you know, I need to take a step back before I react and realize that I am powerless over whatever is going on, that my life is unmanageable because my thinking is in error, and that I need to do something different in step two, and I need to make a decision to go through with the rest of the steps and then to inventory that and talk about it to somebody else. If I did do something wrong, when I figure out what the exact nature of my wrongs was, when I do that spot check inventory or write something down on paper, and then to give those character defects up, and then to write whatever wrong that I did. So that is what step 10 is about. And then the fifth instruction that they give in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is about resolutely helping others. Is after we have harmed somebody and have made amends, that we go out and help somebody else, help another alcoholic start thinking about other people. So that is step 10.
Right, that's powerful. And, you know, the invitation's always there to share the tools with others, so that fits well with what we've developed in the Wise As That Means Me Again work. And for me, as I look at the 10th step, I think that the wake-up sheet, the reality management wake-up sheet, is the perfect tool for the 10th step, ongoing personal inventory and resolution of issues. So if somebody, you know, when we get people started on the wake-up sheet, we usually suggest they do 5 a day for the first 40 days. And we've had people carry that tradition on in their lives for decades, that they do. It's just part of their lives. Just like they wash their face every day, they wash their minds every day. And they go through the process of forgiveness, you know, 5 times a day, every day. And that's really going through the whole process and taking the inventory and then cleaning out whatever you find there. And as one undoes block to truth, new issues, new perspectives show up. And I notice there's a lot of focus on the word wrong there, and I like to help people to shift that focus a little bit to recognize that, you know, the position that I'm in right now and what I did that seemed so wrong might actually be the thing that delivers me to healing. And so maybe it wasn't wrong, but it wasn't the highest and best choice at the moment. And to put it in the category of, well, for my true spiritual journey, living as an alive, awake, aware human being, perhaps this was a necessary step. There were certainly higher ways I could have done it, so maybe it was not right. But when I give it a categorical wrong, I can tend to lock myself into that pattern. And to me, the whole idea is to unlock myself from the patterns that don't support the expression of my true human life of aliveness, of joy, of creativity, and of love in my life, compassion. So the letting go a little bit of the positive wrongs and, okay, so that wasn't the highest and best choice. So now I'm going to make a new choice. I'm going to clean that one up. I think opens a different quality of energetic space.
Agreed.
Cool. So we're at step 11 then. We've got two
we're
more steps.
We're step 11.
10 minutes. Yay.
Okay. 5 minutes apiece. Step 11 is we continue through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Bill Wilson gives three suggestions, I believe, in step 11 and when he wrote the big book, and that was to have contact with God at night in reviewing our day, and also have contact with God in the morning in order to ask for guidance for our day. And also in times of irritation or in question, to stop, take a pause, and connect. One of the prayers that he suggests, Bill Wilson knew that he was not a spiritual giant, and he was knew that he was walking on pretty thin ice with suggestions of spiritual direction to go in. And so he kept things very vague here, and I'm grateful that he did, to allow others to grow in the direction that they see fit after they get to step 11. And definitely I'm grateful that step 11 is where step 11 is, because we need to make all these changes and 1 through 10 to clear the path, in order to connect to God better. I describe it when I talk to people that I sponsor, is that we start out with maybe a black and white antenna TV connection going on. Like I remember only getting three channels in the 70s, trying to watch Gilligan's Island, and going to, after working the steps and continuing to work the steps, especially the inventory, we able to get to, you know, Blu-ray, Dolby surround sound when it comes to having a connection with God. And we're able to allow God to direct our mind instead of self-centered fear directing our mind. And go ahead.
I think a really important step in or piece to understand in that place is the first century Aramaic definition of the word prayer, and that is to set a trap for God, to be the space where love shows up. And I think that is so on target. You start the morning and you breathe and you step into that connected space of love. Before you go to sleep at night, the last thing you do is appreciation and step into that active space of love. And then it becomes a habit. And I can remember as a kid being told, there will come a time when your whole life will become a prayer. And, you know, at that time in my world, prayer was you're down on your hands and knees. And it's like the only thing I could imagine out of that was square knees. Mm-hmm. Where now I understand that what Yeshua was talking about is prayer. And if you listen to the Lord's Prayer, it's not a prayer. What people call the Lord's Prayer is not a prayer. It's an instruction on how to become the space where active love shows up in the world. So to get to the point where we're in constant contact with that active presence of love, to me, is the focus of the whole body of work in this step, to live there 24/7, 365, ultimately. And, you know, that it just becomes the energetic space that we're plugged into continuously. And then to recognize the only thing that will unplug us from that space is our own hostility or fear. And so if somebody comes along that activates our hostility and fear, oops, there's my next piece of work. Oh, thank you, friend, or what yesterday I might have called enemy, for showing me that. I didn't know I had that in me. There's my next piece of work. There's the thing that inhibits me functioning as the space of love. And it just opens a whole different doorway.
Agreed. Agreed, and thank you. One of the prayers
putting that in air quotes, that he suggests is the one by St. Francis of Assisi.
Yes.
Where I sow hatred, help me to sow love. And I can't quote the rest of it right now, but
where there's injury, pardon.
Yes. Yes.
And you know,
so that is one of the suggested prayers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an awesome, powerful prayer. It's powerfully spoken by Saint Teresa in, or Mother Teresa in the that movie that I was talking about earlier, The Letters. It's she speaks it, and it's quite powerful in her process and in her life. And to recognize that the whole process becomes that of doing our work, and it's a continuous, ongoing opening to deeper and deeper experiences of literally the presence of love in every cell of our structure, so we're plugged into that continuously. And of course, once you do that, the 12 steps kind of naturally, you're going to extend that to others.
Absolutely. A little side note, people consider pursuing their separate spiritual path to be their 11th step. I consider becoming one of the first things that I did after I got to step 11 was to become a Reiki master teacher. That was a part of my 11th step process. And believe it or not, that 11th step, that brought me to you. The gentleman that introduced me to Reiki, actually I was doing a home daycare and I had three moms that were second level Reiki practitioners. So I thought that was a hint that maybe this was something to pursue. So the gentleman that attuned me to Reiki 1 and Reiki 2 introduced me to Celebrating Life Ministries, which was an organization that was started by Ron Roth, who was a born healer. And from listening to Celebrating Life Ministries on a teleconference, I was introduced to Dale Allen Hoffman. And from Dale Allen Hoffman, I was introduced to you. So I consider being a part of Celebrating Life Ministries, being a part of knowing Dale Allen Hoffman and being taught to do toning and Aramaic and being introduced to what the real words are and the real meanings and the possibilities of who Mary Magdalene was, is, and Yeshua, learning his true name and then being led to you and studying under you, I consider all that to be a part of my 11th step.
Right. Cool. And then the next step, and we're down to just the last minute or so, of course,
okay,
is to invite others into the process, right?
Yes, there's three parts to the 12 step, and that is to have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps is one of it. I feel like I have a spiritual awakening every day. The second part is to carry the message to others and to practice these principles in all of our affairs, to carry the message to others. And AA terminology is to share experience, strength, and hope, to teach people how to work the steps, to be a tour guide through the AA literature and to introduce them to God. That is the message. And to practice these principles in all of our affairs is to work the steps in every area of our life.
Awesome.
I think I did that under 30 or 60 seconds.
You did. And so we are down to just the last few seconds. And much, much appreciation.
I'm grateful for this opportunity.
Yeah, we're going to do a bit of a poll and decide what day of the week we're going to turn into